I don't really have any particular good talk for the Good Friday, which is sort of a thematic Good Friday talk. But so I'm just going to give a very ordinary talk about a part of the Buddhist practice. And what I want to talk about is the Noble Eightfold Path. And the reason, one of the three reasons why I want to talk about this is because one of the fascinating things that I always found about the Buddha suttas, that when you start reading the Buddha's word in the suttas, you find that very much of what the Buddha talks about is about the practice that we're supposed to do, what we're supposed to be doing. So much is about the path. And very often he talks about this path through various categories, you know, how you have things like, those of you who are Buddhist, have been Buddhist and have come here often, you will know about these things. You have things like the five faculties and the four satipatthanas and all these things, something called the gradual training, and all these things which talks about the path of practice. And I always found this as one of the wonderful things about Buddhism, that it is such a pragmatic path. It talks about what to do, how to act, how to actually behave in the world, and how to get results through that practice. It's about faith as well, but the main thing in Buddhism is about practice. That is one of the things that has always drawn me towards the Buddhist teaching. And the most important way that the Buddha explained this path of practice of Buddhism is, of course, the Noble Eightfold Path. And that's why I want to talk about that. The Noble Eightfold Path, you find it in the part of the Four Noble Truths. And the Four Noble Truths is basically the main way that the Buddha explained the Dhamma, that he explained his teachings. And the fourth of these Noble Truths is called the Noble Truth of the Eightfold Path, of the path which leads to enlightenment. So it's the most important aspect, the way that the Buddha explained the practice of the Buddha's teachings. I'm going to try to explain it in a slightly different way than usual, because otherwise it might get too boring here. But before I even get started, I just want to maybe briefly to summarize the eight factors, particularly for those people who may not have been here before, not so much about the Buddha's teachings. It can be quite nice to have a brief summary of all the eight factors. So the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is called right view. And right view means, basically what it means is that we align the way we look at the world with the way the world actually is. That's basically what it means. The second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is called right intention. And this basically means that we intend out of loving kindness, out of compassion for other beings. And a bit further on the path, you also intend what is called renunciation. I can explain that maybe a bit more later on. Third factor is called right speech. Essentially, right speech is speech which is harmless to other people. So it means speech which is truthful, not lying. Speech which is gentle, not harsh. Speech which unify people, unite people, and don't actually break people apart. And lastly, speech which is meaningful, not speech which is, you know, idle chatter and the gossip and that sort of thing. So that's basically the speech factor. The fourth factor is right action. And this includes things like not killing living beings, not stealing, and not committing, if you like, unlawful sexual acts. And then there is right livelihood, which is a livelihood which does not which doesn't do any harm to other beings or people. And after that, you have right effort, which is the effort to overcome the unwholesome and to build up wholesome states. That is the right effort. Then you have the right mindfulness, which basically is about being mindful and developing the mind in meditation through mindfulness. And finally, you have right concentration, which is the deep states of meditation called the jhanas. This is the final factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And one thing about this Noble Eightfold Path, which is rarely talked about, which actually is quite significant in the suttas, that is that this sequence from right view all the way to right concentration, this is not a random sequence. There is actually a system to this sequence. And the system is that from the beginning to the end, each factor conditions the next factor. So you start off with right view. Then when you have right view, right intention tends to arise because of right view. then, for right intention, you actually get the morality factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, right speech, right action, right livelihood. Then, when you have that morality in place, then comes right effort. You can start to purify the mind, which is the more refined unwholesome states, if you like, after you have purified your virtue. And then you can start doing meditation proper, which is Satipatthana practice. You cannot really do meditation proper until you have refined the mind to a fairly high degree. And then when you do meditation through the Satipatthanas, that's when you have the possibility of reaching the deep states of meditation, such as the jhanas. So there is a causal sequence here, leading from the beginning to the very end. And that causal sequence is not just linear, it's not just that it goes from right view all the way to right concentration or right meditation, if you like. There's also like a feedback there. The more you develop the higher aspects of the path, they also support the primary, the earlier aspects of the path. But the most important relationship here is from right view leading up to right samadhi, right concentration. And one thing that you can notice about this sequence straight away, which is fascinating, is that it starts off with right view. Right view is the first factor on this path. And what does that mean? Well, what that means that unless you have some degree of right view in your life, the whole Eightfold Path, the whole practice of Buddhism basically falls apart. There's got to be some sort of right view there. Otherwise, this Eightfold Path can't even start. It depends on right view to even start off. And that's why right view is the first factor in the sequence. If you don't have it, the whole thing basically doesn't work. And that becomes quite important, because that shows us that the development of right view actually is an important factor of this Noble Eightfold Path. And I'll talk more about that in a second, how to actually develop this factor of right view here. The other interesting thing here, which we can note straight away, is that the path ends with right meditation or right concentration. These things called the jhanas or samadhi, which you may have, many of you probably heard about. And that is also interesting, because usually the way we understand Buddhism is that the path ends with wisdom. It doesn't end with meditation or concentration, but it ends with wisdom. So it's fascinating here to note that the Noble Eightfold Path actually ends with samadhi here. Now, why is that? Why does it end with meditation? And the reason for that seems to be simply that the path, the practice you do, only goes as far as the jhanas, only goes as far as deep meditative concentration. From then on, everything else is automatic. Once you have the jhanas, those deep insights, deep understandings, the wisdom, if you like, faculty, it happens automatically here. So this also, of course, shows us the importance of these jhanas. The fact that the jhanas actually are the final stage of the path. This is the last thing you do. Basically what it means is that we are very, very close to full enlightenment, to full awakening, to total wisdom when we actually attain these jhanas. That's what the Noble Eightfold Path shows us, because they end with these jhana states. Okay, so that's just some preliminary remarks on the Eightfold Path. Now I'm going to analyze the factors a bit more, and I'm going to show basically the relationship between these factors in a bit more detail. The difficult thing with a thing like Noble Eightfold Path is that it has 8 factors. And that may not seem like much, but it is actually quite a lot, because you can very easily start to wonder, well, how do all these 8 factors actually work together? What is the relationship between these factors? And what do they all mean? How come we have 8 factors? Can they maybe be summarized in an easy way to understand? And that is what I want to do today. I want to summarize these factors into a very simple concept so as to make it more clear how they all work together. And then I want to show also the relationship between these factors at the same time. So I'm going to start off with right view. And the first thing to note about right view, and again, this is something which is rarely talked about, and that's why I want to emphasize it a little bit this evening. And that is, the first aspect of right view is actually to have the belief or the view that there are people in the world who have seen something more than we have seen, who understand something more than we understand, who have a wisdom beyond our own. And I think you can see why that is the case, because why would anybody come, for example, here to the Buddha Society on a Friday night unless they thought that Buddhism had something which was some sort of wisdom, some sort of understanding about life, which can make your life better, could improve your life in some way. Nobody would come here if they thought it was more miserable. They would make their life more miserable. So in a sense, all of us who are here already today, we obviously have some faith that Buddhism has some sort of wisdom, some sort of understanding which can improve our lives. And this becomes very important, because if you don't have any kind of faith that the Buddha had some special wisdom, some special understanding, well, you're never going to approach Buddhism. You're never going to be interested in the Buddha's teaching. And because of that, you're never even going to start the Noble Eightfold Path. The whole path, the whole Buddhist practice just falls apart and stops right there, because you think the Buddha, he was just an ordinary man, just like all the rest of us. So this then becomes very important. And the question then becomes, of course, well, how can we actually improve our understanding and our confidence that the Buddha and Buddhism has something important to teach, has some wisdom, some understanding that we don't have, but that is actually able to improve our lives? How can we increase that? Because the more powerful that conviction becomes, that Buddhism is special, that it has something special to give us, the more powerful then is the beginning of the path. If you make the very foundation of the path very strong, then the rest of the path will come much more easily. There are several things we can do to actually increase that faith and confidence and trust in the Buddha's teachings, and the feeling that there's a lot of wisdom here. And the first way, which I always like to point out, well, it's at least the simplest way to begin with, that is, of course, to actually read about Buddhism, to find out what does this teaching actually teach, what is this all about. Most people, once they start reading about it, will realize that there is so much wisdom in this teaching. There's so many beautiful sayings which were said by the Buddha, that most people will become very attracted by it. If you don't become attracted by it, if you don't like it, I think it's still good to read about it, because at least then you know that you don't like this teaching. So this is the first thing to do. And you may ask, well, okay, what exactly should I read? Where should I find this literature? And in the initial stages, I think the best thing to do is to ask somebody you trust, somebody you feel has some understanding of Buddhism already, and ask them to maybe recommend some literature which they think is good. That, I think, is always a good way of starting off. But then there comes a point when what you really want to find out is, what did actually the Buddha teach? Because it's important to remember that the whole of Buddhism was started by this one man known as the Buddha. He started this whole thing. And all the literature that was written after the Buddha, by all kinds of authors everywhere, some of them have been very clever and very smart and come up with all kinds of theories which added to Buddhism, so to speak. But the point is that all of these other authors, they existed because of the Buddha. If it hadn't been for the Buddha, they could not even have done what they did. They couldn't have written anything, done anything. So the Buddha is the fountainhead. He's the source of this whole thing. He is the one who discovered this whole thing. And by that very fact, that the Buddha is the one who discovered it, he must also be the one who is the most wise. So we should always go back to try to figure out, what did actually the Buddha say here? And then we can know whether those teachings we have read before or afterwards or whenever actually match reasonably well with that word of the Buddha. And fortunately, there is today a fairly large consensus among scholars, people who have studied these issues in detail, what actually is the word of the Buddha. And the word of the Buddha you will find in things like the Pali Canon, which is the main source, the main scriptural source of Theravada Buddhism. It's not the same as Theravada Buddhism. Theravada Buddhism is much more than the Pali Canon. But the core of Theravada Buddhism are these teachings which were given by the Buddha. And you also find it in the Mahayana tradition. In the Mahayana tradition, you have something known as the Agamas. And the Agamas have been compared. I'm actually reading a study right now by a German monk who is doing a comparison of the Chinese Agamas with the Pali Canon. And it's very, very, very close. Very fascinating when you read this. Because the Chinese Agamas and the Pali Canon, they actually diverged from each other over 2,000 years ago. And yet, to this day, they are very, very close and almost similar. The core teachings, in fact, are almost exactly the same. So for that reason, we know today pretty much what the word of the Buddha is. And if you ever get to that stage and you feel like you really want to find out what the Buddha taught, I would recommend you to read the suttas, because that's when you really find out whether there is an affinity for you there with the Buddha's teachings. So that is the first way. Read about it. Find out about Buddhism. Try to understand at least the concepts and the doctrines that the Buddha taught. And see if it makes any sense to you. If it makes sense, then it will be for your benefit. If it doesn't make sense, well, then at least you know that much. The second aspect is to get some inspiration from some of the people around you who have been practicing this path for a long time. They can be monks or nuns, or they can be just lay people who have been practicing for a long time and who have been reaping benefits from the teachings. And get some inspiration to actually see that there are people out there who have gotten those benefits which the Buddha taught, which the Buddha said you will get if you practice the path. Because that becomes very powerful. Because one thing is like a theoretical framework that the Buddha taught. You will get this if you do this. But when you actually see that it works, you see the living example that somebody actually has done this, and these states are possible, these qualities are possible to develop, that increases faith much more. So see if you can find some people who you can take as a kind of a role model and see, wow, they can do it. Okay, I should also be doing this. But the most powerful, maybe of all, or way of gaining confidence and faith in the Buddha and the Buddha's teachings, is by starting the practice yourself. And then feel what happens when you start practicing the Dhamma. See if it actually has those results that the Buddha said it would have. And when you find that it has those results, that of course is when the confidence really, really starts to establish itself. When you start to feel happier, lighter, more joyous, more peaceful, more tranquil, all these positive qualities in the mind start to occur. That's when the true confidence actually happens. And sometimes people probably wonder why on earth, many people wonder that actually, why on earth have you become a monk? They would ask monks, also myself. And the reason is simply that over having been a monk for 12 years now, I can see what incredible benefit it has had in terms of the mental development. I can read the suttas and I can see it actually is working in that same way that the sutta said it would work. And that is when it becomes powerful, it becomes stronger. And that's when you get that faith and confidence in these teachings. And I think that as long as I can see those benefits in myself, that it actually works according to the way it is supposed to work, then I will continue to be a monk. I cannot see any reason why I shouldn't be a monk. If for some reason one day I should stop to gain those benefits, which I cannot really see happening, but if it should stop, well, that's when I probably would start to reconsider whether it really is worthwhile being a monk anymore. But so far, for 12 years, it has definitely been the right thing to do. So this is basically the very beginning of the path. Once you start doing these things, reading about the Buddha, starting to gain the experience yourself that these teachings actually work for yourself, then your confidence in the Buddhism and in the Buddha, the Dhamma, will grow and become much stronger. And then when that confidence becomes more powerful, you have much more incentive to practice the Eightfold Path. It becomes much more powerful. So that is the very first aspect of right view. I've never heard of anybody who talked about it before, but it's obviously, for me, it's very important because it is the fountainhead from which everything else springs on the Buddhist path. But the second factor of right view, this is more, if you like, Buddhist doctrine in its more ordinary sense, and that is the view of karma and rebirth is the second factor of right view. And this becomes very important also. I'll show you what actually happens here. It becomes very important as a foundation for developing the path. Because once you have an idea that there is some such a thing as rebirth, and that rebirth depends on the actions you do in this life, then obviously your incentive to do good and to avoid bad is going to be very, very powerful. You may, and you can see the causal connection here. Right view then actually gives rise to right action. Because you have the view that your actions matter, you will actually start to act accordingly. And this is what I meant when I said before that there's a causal relationship here between all these factors. Right view gives rise to right intention. And then right intention gives rise to right action. You have the view that there is karma and rebirth. That gives rise to the intention of doing good and not doing bad. When you have that intention, you actually start doing those things. The point here with right view in the terms of karma and rebirth is that it's not a doctrine in the ordinary sense, something that we have to believe in very, very strongly. The point is that the Buddha says to us, well, this is what I have seen for myself, that there is such a thing as karma and rebirth. Because I've seen it for myself, I'm going to tell you that this is the reality. This is actually the way the world works. So the point here about the right view of karma and rebirth is not so much that we just should believe it, but this is actually according to reality, said the Buddha. And this is the whole point of right view. The whole point of right view is to align the way we look at the world with the way the world actually is. So there isn't a conflict there. There's no conflict between the way we look at the world and the way the world is. Sometimes people are a bit afraid of this idea of right view, that they seem to think that, oh, there's some kind of thought police there which are going to monitor to make sure that we think in the right way and we have the right views, etc. But that's not really the point. The point is that the world works in a certain way, and we are much better off if we look at the world in the way that it actually works. So when it comes to this idea of rebirth and karma, it's not something that we have to take on board 100%. It never really is like that. We don't really have a choice in the matter. It's not as if we can take it on board 100%. It will just be a natural feeling. Either you can agree with it or you don't. It's not something which you can say, I accept this 100%. But the important thing is to always consider that basically we don't know what's going to happen after we die. We don't know what's going to happen. Maybe it is, as the atheists say, that it's going to be a complete nothingness after we die. But maybe there's going to be something afterward. Maybe there's going to be some kind of rebirth or some kind of heaven or hell, that, like, as the Christians would argue and the Muslims would argue. We just don't know. And it is that lack of knowledge which opens up the possibility that there is such a thing as rebirth. I often like to talk about, sometimes people think that science, in a sense, have proved that there is no such thing as rebirth, but science hasn't really proved anything at all. Science is just agnostic and don't really know what's going to happen after we die. So because we don't know, and because we have to accept that when we don't know, that possibility exists, that there is such a thing as rebirth, then we have to take it into account. Even if we think that there's only a 5% possibility of rebirth, still it becomes very important. And it becomes important because the consequences of rebirth are so enormous. Imagine if you get reborn once, then the chances are that you will get reborn again as well after that, again and again and again, many, many, many times over. And when you think of it in that way, then even if there's only a 5% chance that there is such a thing as rebirth, then the consequences of the actions you do in this life, if they affect an innumerable lives in the future, consequences become enormous. So that 5% chance becomes something which you have to take very, very seriously. And that's why the idea of rebirth and karma then becomes very important. And for many of us, the idea of rebirth and karma is going to be a much higher chance than just 5%. It's going to be maybe 50%. For myself, I must admit, I have a very strong faith that this is actually the case. Even though I can't really say for myself that I know these things, at least I have very, very strong confidence that this actually is what's going to happen. Okay. So that is the karma, or the part of right view, which is karma and rebirth. And you can see how that idea leads us towards good actions and away from bad actions. How, in effect, that sequence begins with right view leading to right intention and on to right action. The last factor of right view, which is the most profound one and the most important one, This is the fact of right view, which is the full understanding of the Dhamma, of the nature of reality, as the Buddha taught. And this nature of reality, of course, is what the Buddha called the Four Noble Truths. And this understanding is also the most profound one. And in brief, what the Four Noble Truths really say is that any kind of existence is always going to be to some extent unsatisfactory. And that the best thing to do for a human being is to get off this wheel of rebirth altogether. That's basically the summarization of those Four Noble Truths in a very simple way. And of course, when the Buddha realized that existence is unsatisfactory, it's never going to be perfect, it's always going to have its negative aspects, and he realized that he had found enlightenment, he had found a way out of this predicament, but all the other beings in the world had not found that way out of this predicament. Then, of course, enormous compassion arose in the Buddha, because he realized all these beings are traveling around and they are suffering unnecessarily. They're going through all kind of troubles and pains when in fact there is a path, there is a way to end all these problems. So the Buddha's compassion was aroused. And then from that point, of course, the Buddha wanted to teach this doctrine. He wanted to teach this profound doctrine which shows the cessation of rebirth in this thing we call samsara. So the first thing then the Buddha had to ask himself was, well, what is the condition that leads to the awakening, to the understanding of this powerful truth, this Four Noble Truth? So the understanding that any type of existence, ultimately, there is some unsatisfactoriness there. And at this point, we can bring up the life story of the Buddha, just very briefly, because it shows you very clearly what actually happened at this point. Because the Buddha himself, obviously, he had to travel the same path, the same Eightfold Path, to reach his own full awakening. Otherwise, he wouldn't have awakened. So the life of the Buddha gives a very clear indication of what actually, how this thing works, and how enlightenment becomes possible. And very briefly, for those, many of you will probably know this story very well already, but very briefly, the Buddha was born in a very prosperous circumstances in the north of India 2,500 years ago. His father was a chieftain in a small village, not a small village, I should say a small country. And he basically had all the luxuries in life that people can wish for or could wish for in those days. The best food, the best clothes, big mansions, etc., etc. And he was basically very sheltered because he had such a pleasant upbringing. And he had the best that sensuality, the sensual world can really offer to a young person. Then the Buddha became aware that, well, actually there is more to life than just sensuality and just enjoying life. There is also difficulties in life. He realized in particular that there is such things as sickness, old age and death. And that these things are part and parcel of human life. You cannot just have all the fun, all the joys of sensuality, but you also have to have the negative aspects of life, which is death, old age, and sickness. And when the Buddha realized this, he thought, well, how can I just continue heedlessly enjoying myself when life actually isn't as good as it may seem on the surface? And when he realized that, the Buddha was so wise already at this stage. Well, he wasn't the Buddha yet, I should say. He was practicing to become the Buddha. He was so wise that he actually decided, well, I'm going to give up this whole household life and I'm going to become an ascetic, a monk, if you like. Obviously, there wasn't any Buddhist monks yet. And he decided to renounce the household life and become a Buddhist, a monk, an ascetic. And then he undertook some very, very severe practices known as self-mortification, basically, whereby you try to you mortify the body. In other words, you're almost like torturing the body by eating very little, by sleeping where it is very cold or very hot, by doing all kinds of ascetic practices. And he took that practice of self-mortification to such an extreme that it would have been impossible, he said, to go any further and without actually dying from it. He took it to the absolute extreme. And then he realized, well, I can't go any further on this path. I've taken it to its extreme. Now what? And he thought, I've taken the sensuality to its extreme by living in a very rich household life. I've taken self-mortification, self-torture to the other extreme. Neither of these worked for me. What should I do next? And then this is when he had his famous recollection of when he was a child, the recollection of the moment of deep samadhi, deep concentration, deep meditation he had when he was only 12 years old. And this state he achieved then are known as the jhanas, a jhana state, a very deep, powerful state of meditation. And then he realized that this is the path to enlightenment. This is the way to enlightenment. So then, when the Buddha then later on, actually maybe it's fascinating here, just to, as a slight detour, fascinating here to know that the Buddha was only supposed to be only 12 years old when he had this deep samadhi state. And yet, at this point in his life, he was 35 when he recalled this. And even though this was then 23 years later, this state was obviously so clear and so powerful in his mind still that he understood that this is the path to enlightenment. And that gives you some indication of the power of these states. They must be so powerful that after 22 years, it is still very, very clear in your mind that this state is able to to help you to wisdom, to some understanding, to something deeper. And that is that gives you some indication, as I said, about the power of these states. But anyway, so at this stage then, the Buddha then reflected, well, I'm going to teach the Dhamma, and it becomes then obvious that what he should teach is that you have to attain these deep states of samadhi, meditated concentration, before you can attain full awakening. So that then became the last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, because the Buddha realized this is what is required for enlightenment. So when you reach the last stage of the Noble Eightfold Path, the jhanas, that's when you are basically there. You basically have reached, come to the goal of enlightenment. Then the Buddha asks, well, what then is the cause? What is the condition for the arising of these jhanas? That becomes the next question. And here the important thing to realize is that these jhanas are states of mind which are completely pure. There's no defilements there. There are no negative or unwholesome qualities whatsoever. The mind is completely purified. The mind is powerful, it's blissful, it is very, very peaceful. So these are the qualities which are required. Now, how can I bring about these qualities in the mind? And also, it's a very unified state. It's a very powerful because it's unified. The mind has come together, so to speak. It's not distracted anymore at all. It's completely unified, completely concentrated. And what brings about this state is meditation practice. In other words, the four satipatthanas. The four satipatthanas, the four foundations of mindfulness, or meditation if you like, these are the condition for the arising of the jhanas. That's interesting because most people don't realize that. Most people think that satipatthana is all about insight practice. It's also about insight, but the main aspect of satipatthana, when you start reading the suttas and start to understand the conditionality of the sequence, the main importance of it is that it forms the condition for attaining the jhanas. And why is that? It is because when you practice the satipatthanas, what in effect you are doing is you are removing the very last defilements, the very last impurities from the mind. You're taking them away. And this is the purpose of satipatthana, to remove those last minor defilements. And the second purpose of satipatthana is to bring the mind to unity so that it becomes powerful and concentrated and you can enter these deep states of meditation known as the jhanas. And then you may ask, well, how do we practice these satipatthanas? Because I must admit, I always was a bit dumbfounded when I started reading about meditation. And sometimes you get these enormous manuals of satipatthana. They can be enormous. It can seem very complex and very complicated. But in fact, there is also a very simple way of looking at the satipatthanas. And again, this is directly from the discourses of the Buddha, this simple way of looking at it. Because it is from the discourses of the Buddha, I think it's important to take this way of looking at it very, very seriously, because that's where it comes from, the horse's mouth, as I say. And that is simply that anapanasati, which is the mindfulness of breathing, this is the meditation practice which fulfills and completes the satipatthana practice. In other words, all you have to do to practice satipatthana is to do mindfulness of breathing. In other words, the meditation, which is the watching of the breath. And that meditation then can take you all the way through all the four satipatthanas. That is quite nice, isn't it? You don't have to worry about all these complexities that sometimes you seem to encounter when you start asking what satipatthana is. All you have to do is do breath meditation. And you may wonder, well, how is it that breath meditation can fulfill all the satipatthanas? Those of you who know a bit about these things know that satipatthana practice is about contemplation of the body, about contemplation of feelings, about contemplation of mind, and of contemplation of phenomena. The reason is that as you watch the breath and as your meditation becomes more powerful on the breath, you actually go through stages which are equivalent to all the satipatthanas. You go through stages where feelings of the mind become very powerful, feelings of bliss, feelings of joy become very strong. And this then becomes the satipatthana on feeling. While you're watching the breath, these powerful states of feeling arise in the mind. Not only that, but as you practice satipatthana, the mind starts to become very concentrated and very peaceful. And this then becomes the satipatthana, which is the contemplation of the mind. Again, it arises because you're watching the breath, because the breath is calming you down and making you peaceful. And finally, you can actually watch the breath, you can watch the breath disappearing, you can watch the breath ceasing, and this then becomes the insight contemplation of phenomena, which is the last aspect of the satipatthanas. And I think for me this is a very beautiful teaching and a very powerful teaching, because it's very simple. It's very nice to know that all you have to do with meditation practice is watching the breath, and that's how complicated it gets. It doesn't go beyond that. And it's also important to know that the breath meditation is the one subject the Buddha taught the most in the suttas. You find it again and again and again. So it's not just an unimportant or minor meditation subject. It's actually a very important one. And for that reason, it is not something we should take lightly, so to speak. But as many of you will know, those of you who have been meditators for a long time, meditation on the breath is not necessarily very easy. It can be very difficult. And the reason why meditation on the breath can be very difficult, or the satipatthanas can be difficult, is simply because the mind isn't pure enough yet to be able to watch a very subtle object, the breath being very subtle. So what then happens is that then the Buddha asks himself, well, what is the cause, what is the condition for the arising of the satipatthanas? What is the cause, the condition, which makes the satipatthanas possible? And the answer to that question is the four right efforts. It is the four right efforts, the step before satipatthanas on the Eightfold Path, which makes satipatthana possible. And why is that? It is because the purpose of the four right efforts is to remove unwholesome states and to build up wholesome states in the mind. And as you increase those wholesome states and you reduce those unwholesome states, you come to the point where the mind becomes so pure that you're able to watch the breath quite easily. And so the four right efforts then is basically such things as devoting yourself to loving-kindness meditation, to compassion of other beings, to try to overcome things like anger and negativity, and excessive greed, restlessness, sloth and torpor, all these things which we teach in the meditation classes here in the Buddhist society. All those things are the things that the four right efforts is about. And then gradually, slowly, step by step, the mind becomes more pure, the mind becomes more powerful, until you come to the point where watching the breath and satipatthana practice becomes quite effortless, quite easy. But again, even the removal of the unwholesome qualities of mind is actually quite advanced. Some people find it, can start straight there. Some people can start straight with meditation practice. But for many, many people, I would say by far the large majority, even this is difficult to do. Because when you're dealing with the mind, you're already dealing with something very refined. So the question then the Buddha asks is, well, what is the condition? What is the cause for these four right efforts? What do I have to do to make the full right efforts possible. And the answer to this question is, of course, virtue. It's goodness, which is the most is the cause and the foundation for the full right efforts. Basically, we have to do those things which are the three factors, factor 3, 4, and 5 on the Noble Eightfold Path. These are the things we have to do to be able to practice the four right efforts. This is right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And these are the morality part of the Noble Eightfold Path. And so this is then, if you like, the coarser or the grosser kind of purification that we have to do before we can start purifying the mind. In other words, we have to purify the speech and our actions before it becomes really possible to purify the mind directly. And the reason for that is basically that if you look carefully at what's happening when you live a virtuous life, you live a good lifestyle, you're not really purifying the body, you're not purifying speech. What you're purifying is the mind. Because the mind is the cause for that unwholesome speech or the wholesome speech. The mind is the cause for the bad action and the good action. So by stopping the bad actions and increasing the good actions, you're actually purifying the mind. You're starting on the coarse levels of the purification of the mind. And then as your sila, your virtue becomes more powerful, then there comes the point when you can actually start and practice the mental purification directly, which is the four right efforts. So that is now you come back to virtue. The virtue in the daily life is what we come back to now. And this is the basis, you know, when we become Buddhist, this is very often what we do. We take the five precepts, and that is the beginning of the practice in the Noble Eightfold Path. So then you can start to see, well, what's happening here? What is this whole thing about? And you will realize that what this whole thing is about, this whole Eightfold Path, it is about purification. It's nothing but purification from the very beginning to the very end. It's a gradual purification, starting with the coarsest defilements, leading up to the most refined defilements in the mind, until the mind is so bright, so powerful, that you can enter deep states of meditation, which then can give rise to the deep wisdom. And that is how you can see the Eightfold Path in a nutshell. It's a path of purification. It's the name of a famous work in the Pali, in the Theravada tradition called the Visuddhimagga. It literally means the path of purification. And this is what the Eightfold Path is about. It's about precisely purification. Purification, purification, step by step by step, until the mind is so powerful, so bright, so strong, that you can penetrate into the nature of reality. And that is what we're aiming at, because that is where wisdom is to be found, true wisdom. But we can bring it back even a little bit further. We can bring it back to, well, what is the cause and condition for virtue? And the cause or condition for virtue is right intention. You have to intend kindness, intend goodness, intend compassion before you can really start acting in a virtuous way. And the cause and the condition for right intention is right view. So there you are, back to the very beginning again. Because if you haven't got right view, then you won't be kind to other people. If you have got completely wrong view, if you think that killing others, stealing is perfectly all right, it doesn't make any bad karma, it doesn't really hurt anybody, then of course you're going to do those things. And you have no chance to even get it started on the Noble Eightfold Path. So that is the whole cycle there. And the main point I want to make is that once you have right view, once you have this idea that it's important to practice this path to purify your mind, then everything else is about purification. Everything else after that is purification, 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 until you have attain a state where you can see into reality as it actually is. Okay. I guess the one important question to answer is I lost my thread of thought there. Yeah, I can't remember what I was going to say next. So basically, it is about, the whole path is about a purification practice, basically. And this, yes, of course, what I was going to say is, well, what is the practical significance of this? Because it's nice to have the theory, it's nice to know how we're supposed to look at this, but how can we bring it down to something practical for our actual practice? And it's actually quite simple. The great thing about knowing that this is all about purification is that you can always ask yourself, well, where am I at in this practice of purification? What do I need to purify? Where is my practice at? Do I need to purify my precepts? Still, are they good? When you sit meditation, you start watching your mind, you start to understand what is happening inside your mind. You will know very quickly whether you need to purify anger, irritation, negative things, or whether you need to purify yourself from restlessness, sloth and torpor, maybe over sensuality and desires. And then it becomes very clear what you have to do. If you think of the whole path in terms of purification, you can always look inside yourself and ask yourself, what do I need to purify? Where isn't this pure yet? And a very good way of finding out where you're at is to try to meditate. Once you try to meditate, the mind will very quickly throw up those obstacles which are the most prominent in your mind. You will very quickly see where your problems are. And that is the benefit of having this kind of overview of the Noble Eightfold Path, to know that it is about purification. Okay, that's all I really want to say here this evening. So, I don't know if there is any questions or comments or anything anybody wants to say. Is this the right time, Saul, to do that? Yeah? Okay. Anybody want to say anything here? Yes? It is part of a more advanced type of right view. In the concept of emptiness is a little bit different in the Theravada tradition from the Mahayana tradition. In the Theravada tradition, emptiness basically means that there is no self. There is no owner in here. And for that reason, there is also nothing which belongs to the self. So we are empty of a substance, empty of something permanent. The Mahayana tradition often takes that concept a bit further. But the essence of it is the absence of the self. And of course, once you get to the point that you become a stream entry, or you actually see the Dhamma for the first time, this is what you realize, this is what you see. You actually see that there is no self there. So on a high level, yes, indeed, that is very much part of right view. It is. But it's very difficult to, before you get to the stage of stream entry, before you get to the stage where you actually see the Dhamma for yourself, it's very difficult to grasp fully this idea of non-self. Because it is very profound. You can see it to some extent, but you can never see it fully until you become a stream entry. Yeah. That makes sense? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anybody else want to say anything? Yeah. Anybody completely confused? Anybody? Are you? I can't repeat everything I said, so. No more comments, sir? Yes? The Four Noble Truths, sir? Yeah, of course, yeah. Okay, the Four Noble Truths, as I mentioned in the very beginning, this is the most central, in a sense, doctrine or teaching in Buddhism. This is the one around which everything revolves, really. Yeah. And this teaching is about, well, in brief, it's the First Noble Truth is the Noble Truth of suffering. Yeah. The second one is the cause of suffering. Yeah. The third one is the ending of suffering. Yeah. And the fourth one is the path which leads to the end of suffering. And it's that path which I have been talking about this evening. Yeah. The other ones, the first noble truth, the truth that there is suffering, yeah, or the truth of suffering, if you like, yeah, basically means that ultimately, yeah, any kind of existence is unsatisfactory, is suffering, yeah, and that the only way to practice in Buddhism is to actually get out of this whole mess. And that is what is called enlightenment. It's called getting out of the mess of suffering. Yeah. The second noble truth basically shows you that there is a cause for this suffering. Yeah. And it's precisely because there is a cause for it that it is possible to eliminate it. So you have to eliminate the cause. And by taking away the cause, you take away suffering. Yeah. And that cause is called craving or desire. Yeah. The fact that we have that we're always running after things. We always have desires for things. Always have cravings for things. If you eliminate that craving completely, 100%, then you also eliminate suffering, because suffering is a consequence of that craving here. The third noble truth shows precisely that. It shows that when you eliminate craving here, you also eliminate suffering here. It shows that basically, so that it works. Take away craving here, suffering ceases. And then the last one, as I said before, is the Eightfold Path. That is the path which leads to the end of suffering here. So what do you want to do here? But dependent origination. Okay. I think that might be going too far, actually, Robert. Yeah, it's just too involved, I think. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe a whole series of talks might be more appropriate for that. Yeah. So, yes, down there. Yeah. It is possible, but it's difficult. In fact, very difficult. But it is possible. The thing is that you have to remember that the jhana states are the exact opposite of sensuality here. So the problem is that if you live a sensuous lifestyle there, you're basically barred from attaining these things. You have to at least mentally relinquish sensuality completely to be able to enter these states. So it is possible, because it is possible to temporarily, you know, relinquish all sensuality here, then attain the jhanas, then sort of go back again. It's possible. But it is difficult. So basically, because lay life usually has a strong sensual component, it makes it very hard to attain these deep meditations. But I would recommend you, if you're really interested in that, and you think that maybe your meditation is going really well, maybe you experience sort of bliss and happiness in your meditation, then I would recommend that you go on a retreat, like Ajahn Brahm's 10-day retreat, for example, which is in progress right now. And that is when you have a chance to attain these things, because then you are on the 8 precepts, you live a completely celibate life, you basically live like a monk for those 10 days, or nun. And that is when you have if there ever is an opportunity, that would be a very good opportunity to do it. Yeah. Yes, at the back there. Okay, that's a good point. That's a good point, Eddie. I know what you mean. In fact, there is a nice teaching in the suttas where the Buddha said that when you suffer, that's when you seek a way out. And that's when you seek to a religion or to Buddhism or to whatever, because you want to find a way out of those problems. So that's why many people, sometimes you see people who are very distraught, they will come to the Buddhist society because they want to see if the Buddhism can actually offer them something which can help them out of the problems. So there is a lot of truth to that. But the reason why you stop after you think that you have left that suffering behind is because you haven't really understood that suffering is much more than that state you are feeling just then. If you really understand suffering and really understand how deeply it goes, that is when you become motivated to practice at any time. Because you realize this thing is a much more profound thing than just the unhappiness of the moment or a temporary depression or something like that. It goes much beyond that. And that is why this thing of rebirth becomes so important, you know, because you just never know where you might get reborn next time. You may get reborn somewhere which is very unpleasant. Do you really want that? And if you are going to get reborn forever again and again and again, how many times do you want to go through those unpleasant experiences before you make an end of the whole thing? But it's much more than that. It's also the fact that when you start to meditate and when you start to become more peaceful, then many of these other states of mind that you ordinarily have, they seem very coarse and very gross. And you don't really want to have those states anymore. So it is a relative thing, you know. It depends on what you compare it to. If you compare it to the beautiful states of meditation that you can have, then your ordinary state of mind will seem quite terrible. And you don't really want to be there anymore. You want to get out of even that. So it's a question of perspective. That's what it is. One person's happiness is somebody else's suffering. One person's suffering is somebody else's happiness. One person might feel quite contented with having a state of mind which another person would feel is terrible suffering, because they tend to be much happier. So it's all relative. And that's why when you attain full enlightenment, only then do you leave the whole mess behind, basically. Does that make sense? Yeah. Anybody else want to say anything? No? Okay, maybe we should call it a day. Yeah. So, do you want to? Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, Ajahn.